What's up, everybody? DJM here. First of all, as always, thank each and every one of you for listening to Sports Odds and Ends on behalf of Kaz and JVZ and myself. Thank you all very much for listening. Just an FYI, in the latter part of this episode, when we get into the story about the Houston Astros, the Skype gods decided to smite the podcast while we were recording, and unfortunately, we got a little crunchy, we got a little garbled in the audio, but just wanted to let you know that that happened. Apparently, the Skype gods are Houston Astros fans and didn't like the guys talking about that story and finishing the show. So, apologies for the inconvenience. We hope it doesn't bother your ears too much. But as always, thank you all for listening. Enjoy the show.
What's up, sports fans? Welcome to Sports Odds and Ends, the show for the fly-by-night sports fan. I'm King Kaz. I'm joined by my good friend, the co-host, the one, the great, JVZ.
How you doing, Kaz?
I am doing well. I think just to kind of get right into it, we talked about somebody breaking a world record last week, and now we have more.
Yeah, Armand Duplantis is at it again. He's broken the world record again for pole vaulting. He's at 6.18 meters now instead of 6.17. and it seems like I read that he is basically paid each time he like breaks the world record. So yeah. He's basically just going to up it by a centimeter each time. And he's kind of going on this nice little tour too. So like everybody can come see him break the world record, because it seems like from each of these attempts, he's got plenty of room to clear it, but he doesn't do just like one big jump.
So the only thing that matters, because I was watching this clip, and like you said, he had more than enough room. So, being a fly by night sports fan of kind of track and field things, it's only the bar height that matters.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. So he's not being measured by like what he actually clears.
Mm-hmm. So it's one of these things where he could be going and this is astronomical, like 5 or 10 more feet up above that bar, but the only thing that matters is where the bar is placed.
Yeah. I think, yeah, when you want to go higher, you basically have to have them move the bar up and then you got to set the bar and then you got to clear it.
Okay. So he probably knows like he could probably do more than this, but like you said, he's doing it in a way to get the payday for each of these. And then in a sense, probably waiting for like the Olympics or something like that to maybe go bigger.
Yeah.
And really do so. Okay.
I mean, It's amateur sports, so and track and field in general, there aren't a whole lot of opportunities to get paid for track and field. So you got to take them wherever you can get them. It's kind of, you know, get famous in the Olympics and then use that to, you know, get some sponsorship money. These aren't like, you know, major. I mean, they are major spectator sports, but they're not to the same level of like baseball or football or whatever, where you can schedule, you know, multiple events, 16 events or more per year per team, and generate a ton of money. I'm glad he's found a way to take advantage of his money making structure and make a lot of money from this, because I think after this, like once he hits his peak, then the novelty's kind of over.
Yeah. But it's good media hype. It's good all these things, and then yeah. and then you go for the big play at the Olympics, which you know makes you a household name and gets you on Ellen.
yeah. Assuming the Olympics don't get canceled for coronavirus.
Yeah. Oof, yikes. All right.
All right. DJM asks a pretty interesting question about the XFL.
What's up, guys?
Been talking a little bit. Hey, DJM.
Hey. I know that we have been talking a little bit about this since the XFL has returned, and reviews on it have been mostly positive. So I'm wondering, when do we collectively, as sports fans across the sports fan space in our conversations, when do we start talking about the XFL as a game? When do we start talking about the games, the players, and all of that stuff? When do we start talking about the XFL beyond just the novelty of, oh, hey, the XFL's back? When do we... And I think at that point, that's kind of when the XFL will become a bit more normal beyond the novelty. When do you think that'll be?
I think it flows into a couple of different ways. One is their social media play, getting people to follow it, having these really good highlights that people can see really quickly, that will then bring them into the game, and then going from there, right? Letting your players do the things that they're good at, and then letting hopefully the eyes flow to them. I think one of their biggest hindrances is their ownership. I forget his name, but CEO Luck is what I'll call him.
Oliver Luck.
Oliver Luck is not the most like kind of well-known individual, right? Like, so you can't really tote him out much. Even that's what they've decided to do to kind of be their representation of it.
Well, why can't they? Why can't they?
I think they can. I think he just doesn't that much. But
I just don't think he has the personality for it. He might be a good operations manager, but the interviews I've seen, he doesn't really draw me in. And then I will say the other problem in asking other kind of fly-by-night sports fans like what they think of this, because very notably our friend Bryce was a fan of the AAF because he wanted something new that he could grow with in his fandom. So I asked him, what did he think of the XFL as a product? And he was like, it seems interesting, but his biggest hindrance to that is its connection to Vince McMahon. And then I asked other people what they thought of it, and they were like, oh, you know, I'll kind of wait and see with it. And for most people, oddly enough, that I asked, that everyone else that I asked, they were like, yeah, I'm just kind of glad Vince McMahon has nothing to do with it. And I had to break their hearts and tell them that he still does.
Yeah.
He's only putting in the money.
Like, yeah. It's really the only thing he's doing. It seems like it's run differently than his other products. In the sense that, like, the fact that they actually solicited fan advice to put together like a lot of the rule changes they did, and so it very much feels like a non Vince McMahon product when you factor that in.
And I think that is what has caught some people. But then once they, or at least in my small sample testing, once they learn that he does have something to do with this, they were already turned off. And that's just, you know, to go to show for his involvement in things just in general. So I think if they can kind of keep Vince a secret, and some presence kind of arise, whether it's a player or a coach or something, because I don't think Oliver Luck is enough of a presence to carry the XFL. I think you just kind of. It has to come from somewhere within. It has to come from a player or something like that. Or you do...
JVZ, what do you think? There seems to be, and I know it's early. It's still very, very early. Do you think that it's a... What do you think the disconnect is with the XFL right now? It's still early, granted. I don't know if we are still in the novelty phase and people are still... and people are transitioning towards the idea of it being a regular sports league.
Oh, we are definitely still in the novelty phase.
Yeah,
when do you think we'll get there? How do you think we'll get there?
I think we'll kind of just have to look at end of season numbers, or maybe even by like week four or so. And then, because at that point, we'll be able to tell that that certain teams are trash and other teams are running away with it. And that, I guess this first year, I don't expect the league to be really balanced. It'll only be like after everybody's got a chance to play with each other, and then teams will start, you know, shifting players around. And then eventually we'll get something that has a little bit more parity like the NFL does. But for now, they've done the local market thing and spread teams around the country. And so it's kind of hard to get into it when your local team is trash. So like, I think like it seems like LA fans are already kind of checked out. But maybe that'll change once they get their quarterback back. Josh Johnson, who was one of the, one of the players with NFL experience. So he's going to be a highly watched player. And I think like once we start getting latching onto certain players as household names, maybe not household, but like, you know, these are the faces of the XFL. Then you don't have to rely on a commissioner like Oliver Luck or a figurehead like Vince McMahon to drive interest for the league. It's, this guy's tearing it up in the XFL.
Have any players caught your guys' attention at all?
There's definitely PJ Walker.
Thanks,
last
guess.
Week. Cardale Jones as well had a great game. Had a good couple games. It seems like Houston in general has very much, and maybe we'll see again today when they play, but they've actually had to open up upper deck seating in their stadium because the first week was so successful that ticket sales are kind of going through the roof for them. So,
but is that because of that, or is that because Texas is a football state?
Well, I mean, at the very least, you have to latch onto the...
I'd say it's both.
You have to take the gimmies where you can get them. Yeah. And if Texas is not embracing football, then you know you have a problem. But the fact that it's working there, and the fact that they've managed to establish a good team in Houston, that's...
in D.C. as well, it looks like.
Yeah, in D.C. as well. That's kind of the opposite effect. Like, they've had bad football for so long that not necessarily the whole area, because you know obviously Baltimore has been doing great, but DC football, which with the Washington team has been so terrible for so long that they've latched onto the success of their XFL team. So I think we'll see like pockets of success and then probably drop offs for all the other teams that are kind of obviously bad. And then casual interest for people like me that don't have a local team, I think will probably stay at a fairly low but steady level. Ultimately, the conclusion we came to last week was that the talent level is still pretty high.
Yeah. I think
higher than what we expected. And because of that, I think the league will have staying power. And I think, but yeah, by week four, we'll get over the novelty of, hey, check out this new type of play. I've been touting the, like, oh, we're going to see double forward passes all the time. And it took until week two before somebody actually ran one of those plays. But yeah, like the novelty of her, hey, look at these special kickoffs. Hey, look at the way they're doing replay. Hey, look at, you know, this new fancy thing. I think that's done by week three. And then it's kind of back to serious football talk. But the good thing is that they seem to be doing serious football pretty well.
Cool.
Yeah,
all right, guys.
I can agree with that.
What's going on with the NBA All-Star game?
We had All-Star Saturday weekend last night, all the special competitions. Bam Adebayo from Miami won the skills competition, which I think, I don't want to say it's like the first time a big man has won it, but it's still like it's kind of a sign of where the modern NBA is going. Big men have to be skilled. You can't just be tall anymore. And so it's kind of changing the stigma of that. And I've seen Bam Adebayo play in person recently, and he's pretty amazing. He's a good reason. He's a good reason why Miami is doing so well this year. And it's not just Jimmy Butler, but a lot of the pieces around him have also stepped up. In probably the best news for the Kings in a long time, Buddy Hield won the 3-point competition. They actually changed up the rules this year a little bit for the 3-point competition. They added two extra shots from behind, like way behind the 3-point line, each of those being 3 points each. Strangely enough, Buddy Hield missed all of those that he took, but he managed to get enough points from everywhere else to beat Devin Booker by 1 point. He scored 27 points in both rounds, I think that's been the nice thing about the way Buddy's been playing recently. He's been a lot more consistent since he's been benched, I don't want to say it was like a wake up call, but I think it helped him get back into his groove playing as the first guy off the bench instead of as a starter, even though he's very clearly a starting caliber player. So, hopefully I want to believe that this is the start of the Kings finally getting it together this year. But I'm not holding out too much hope, but there's a little bit of hope there. But the big story coming out of last night is the dunk contest, which I think definitely one of the better dunk contests in recent years. Usually it gets to be kind of boring, but this year Aaron Gordon re-entered the contest, and so this is his third year. And he was pretty much robbed again. Except this time, like it's a lot more egregious. It reached the point where he and Derek Jones Jr., also from Miami, they were at the stage where they kept tying, it reached the tiebreaker stage of the dunk contest, where it's just like you do a dunk and then score 50 on it, and then you do a dunk and then score 50 on it, and then just alternate until somebody for some reason gets shafted by the judges. So what happened this time? They kind of ran out of dunks, and it got to the point where where Aaron Gordon just picked the tallest guy in the room, which was 7'5" Taco Fall, who from the Boston Celtics, who just happened to be in the building at the time, and just brought him out there. He effectively got bullied into having to accept this, but he set up Taco and then just had him hold the ball on his neck, and then jumped over him and dunked. He didn't fully clear him, but nobody died. So he landed that dunk somehow scored a 47 on the dunk. Derek Jones Jr. had scored a 48 on his dunk. So Derek Jones Jr. won the competition. But as soon as the 47 score was revealed, you could see there was something up with the judges, who were very mad at each other, because they had attempted to rig it.
All right, let's just hit this. Let's call it out now, right? So our judges for the dunk contest were Dwayne Wade, Common, Candace Parker, Chadwick Boseman of Black Panther fame and other good movies, and Scottie Pippen of Bulls fame. Yeah. So according to this SB Nation article, Common and Candace Parker are kind of ruled out because they are both on the side of saying there's maybe some sketchy stuff going on. Tie.
They gave the dunk, the last dunk, a 10.
They had both given 10.
They had both given the previous dunk a 9. So I think they decided that, okay, this time these two are going to give it a 10.
Yeah.
And then the other two of the other three were supposed to give it a 9. What they were trying to do was force a tie so that they could go to the, so that they could just vote on I guess who was the best dunker of the night. I think they were going to stop doing the just dunk off phase at this point because really at this point it's just we could just go all night and these guys could just keep hitting 50s and one of the three remaining people fucked up by accidentally giving this a 9.
Right. And so you have Chadwick Boseman, who gave a 9, Scottie Pippen, who gave a 9. And I'm going to have to agree with this article. Number one suspect, Dwayne Wade, giving this a 9.
Yeah. Derek Jones Jr. is his former teammate. Dwayne Wade is a former Miami Heat player. Mm-hmm. Sorry, Miami Heat legend. Just from the reaction of everybody, it seemed pretty clear that that Dwayne Wade at least either messed up or intentionally did this to give the win to his former teammate. Accusations aside, the entire thing just seems stupid at this point. If this was just a dunk showcase, then yeah, this would have been like a really fun night, and then everybody just kind of gets to show off their cool dunks that they want to show off. But the fact that we have to judge every single one of these, and that this is a contest that has all of a sudden turned this into this massive controversy because very clearly the wrong guy won. A guy just dunked. A guy, Aaron Gordon, he hit 50s for every single dunk of the night, except for this last one where he jumped over a person who was 7'5" tall. So the judging just doesn't make sense. And DJM asked the question last night,
the question that I asked last night is, because I find all of this to be a lot of hot air over something that is just kind of inherently arbitrary and stupid. I ask who would judge this contest? Do you have dunkologists that would judge this? I think all of this is just kind of silly. I'm having a very hard time mustering indignation about all of this. I think the only person that would really have something to be indignant about is Aaron Gordon, who now had this taken away from him twice, and now he's saying he's not going to do the dunk contest anymore, and I don't think really anyone could blame him. But generally, did D-Wade screw up? Probably. Did D-Wade vote for his former teammate? Maybe. But it's the slam dunk contest, guys.
But I think the thing is, unlike most sports, right? When we talk about their All-Star weekend and all these things, and I think the dunk contest of all things in the NBA is the biggest standout of everything. I think people who don't even pay attention to the game of basketball would pay attention to the dunk contest in years past. And I think we have finally come back to a position where the dunk contest is starting to have that kind of air around it.
Oh, even now, I saw it in my timeline from people who are not into basketball, so I can definitely confirm that.
So I think it is something that, and it is a skill. There is a lot of skill to it for the game of basketball, but I think, one, there's a lot of limitations on it when it should just be this free reign kind of thing. And two, I think it should be a point where either you just let maybe previous dunk contest winners at this point only be the judge, or you let the fans be the judge in some kind of easy thing.
Let Twitter vote or something.
Yeah. Or just the people who are there. I think trying to make it this kind of dog and pony thing and having these celebrities there and all this other thing, I think that's where it's starting to lose itself. I think it has enough to stand out on its own.
Yeah, and when you've got a scoring system that is so, like, it's not convoluted, like each there's five judges and each of them can score it out of 10 and they add the scores up. But like, nobody knows what the fuck a 10 is supposed to be. So like, you know, and so like these judges are not necessarily, it's weird saying like you're not qualified to judge a dunk, but like, you know, like there's no standard. So
there is no idea of rotations or degree of difficulty, like this would be Olympic swimming or gymnastics or something.
Yeah. So,
and we're not going to get that. And I don't think we should.
So we should just get rid of the judging entirely. Kofi, your boy from SB Nation, actually did a video, or he did an article where he had to like rank all the dunks that have ever scored 50. And there's like 80 of them in like the 30 year history of the contest. And a lot of like the recent years, like it's very saturated, because at some point, like these guys are doing 360 dunks, you know, putting the ball in between their legs. Like everything looks impressive at this point. Like they're jumping over people. They reached the point where they ran out of people to jump over, to the point where they just had to pick the tallest guy in the room and bully that guy into being a prop. And so it's like, there's like a creativity ceiling, but also like at this point, like everything is impressive and nothing is impressive at the same time. So, you know, you combine that with the fact that you've got an arbitrary scoring system and, you know, one where like nobody gets below a 40 when you score these out of 50, and, you know, and everything that is at least mildly impressive should get a 50. It's, you know, just do that and then combine that with the fact that in order to, you know, that the judges just actively rigged this to try to force a tie. It's, you know, when you have a scoring system where you know, to get the quote unquote correct result, the judges feel like they have to collude with each other. Like that's all just adds to the bullshit of this. Like at some point, like we should still
do you want Adam Silver to step in, VZ? Do you want Adam Silver to step in? I want
Adam Silver to step in and say, we are just no longer judging this. If you have a dunk you want to show off, you can show it off. And everybody can ooh and ah, and everybody's still going to share the highlights. And nobody's going to give a shit about what it scored. Because if you land that dunk, it's going to score 50 at this point. You know, if it's impressive. So... like, so there's no point to the scoring system. There's no point in having this be a contest. It's just the dunk showcase, not the dunk
contest.
So
if it becomes, say, the All-Star Weekend Slam Dunk Invitational, what's to stop the NBA from having like 50 guys that want to do a dunk?
I say let's do it. That's
okay. All right.
I've been totally in favor of expanding all of these competitions. Anybody in the fucking building that wants to do the 3-point competition, they should be able to like enter in like at least like qualifying competitions.
Does this mean that I would finally get my dream if the 3-point contest becomes an open invitational and then just out of a cloud of black smoke and robes, Craig Hodges appears out of the darkness to challenge in the 3-point competition.
Yes, I'm totally okay with that. I think there should be like 8 invitees, or actually more than 8, like 12, just because everybody's so good at shooting threes now in the league that like you know you invite 12 people and then have 4 like. You know, qualifier spots, and then like the top 4 people from throughout the day that have done qualifying competitions in the parking lot can join. So like if some
and any former man, like, champion if, can enter, like Mortal yeah, Kombat.
Any former champion, if like and any current player in the NBA or WNBA, you know, like if you know Brooke Lopez wants to enter the competition because you know he shoots threes now, it's like he can do that. Like if big men want to join, if you know, because
Blake Griffin would totally do this if he weren't dead.
Yes, and yeah, he should have a chance to qualify, and you know, you filter all those people in the building, and you know, and get the best ones to get those 4 remaining spots, and then do you know a did the same competition but with 16 people instead of 8. So it's yeah, like these should be open invitationals, you know, for whether it's the skills competition. I think they should just have a giant fucking game of knockout with just everybody in the building who wants to participate. Like that's make all of All-Star Weekend be kind of this open invitational. You know, you can establish whatever qualifying things you want, but you know, but let people who want to show off, and you know, and that's kind of what this league is all about. Because then you don't have you know, it's bullshit that LeBron has never competed in a dunk competition, and it seems like Giannis Antetokounmpo is never going to compete in one. It's kind of this thing for fringe players like either really young players who haven't really made a name for themselves yet or
that's not what it used to be, right? Yeah, it used to be like the best guys around would do this because it had more legitimacy to it. And then it became a fucking dog and pony show and it became the sideshow that it is. So now you have to talk more people into doing it than you actually get people wanting to do it.
Yeah. Like LeBron James 1 year like got on the mic and announced that the next year he was going to enter the dunk competition and then backed out. Like that's you know, like what to me, like I don't under it seems like the only incentive
worse
to,
than the decision that one.
Yeah, yes, I agree. And like it seems like the only reason to back out of something like this is because you are afraid you're going to lose this competition to somebody else. And the only reason you would lose this competition is because of that, the whack-ass judging system and the scoring system that doesn't need to exist, because everybody is still going to ooh and ah over your dunks and share it all over social media nowadays. So there's no point to the judging. Just make it a showcase. Just show off your dunks, and then you don't have to come up with five dunks just in case you end up in a tie with somebody. I got two dunks I want to show off. I've been working on these two. I just want to show them, and then I hope you guys like them. Peace.
Yeah. All right. Going on from there, we have some other things to talk about. So, Jameis Winston, 30 for 30 legend, but not the 30 for 30 you're thinking of. 30 touchdowns, 30 interceptions. Has struggled with his vision his whole career. Has short-sightedness, I think, is...
Yeah, nearsightedness.
Nearsightedness. But it has not necessarily hindered his play, so to speak. But there is talks of him having LASIK surgery, which we've seen kind of some results of this before with Stephen Curry, who also had surgery on his eyes to help his eyesight. I'm trying to think of the question to ask here.
Like, well, the question is, like, I think when the story first came out, I think everybody was joking that, like, holy shit, that's why he's thrown all these interceptions, because he can't fucking see. And apparently, like, people have been making fun of Jameis Winston's vision since he was in college. Like they've been calling him Jameis Squinston, because, like, he's been spotted just squinting at everything. He can't see the scoreboard. He can't see, like, you know, anything that's not, like, in front of him. I mean, I'm sure, like, that means he can still see, like, downfield, but I'm sure just everything's kind of blurry. As is the case with, you know, most nearsighted people, if it's not severe enough that he hasn't been compelled to do this before or to wear contacts before, I think he's tried, and then he's taken them off, and then that happens with some athletes where, like, you know, the contacts are just either uncomfortable or they risk getting them knocked loose while they're in the middle of playing a contact sport. So they end up just opting to not play with them. The reason why he's waited until now to get the surgery is that LASIK surgery isn't recommended until you're 25 years old. Because your vision is changing a lot until that point. And then after 25 or so, it's somewhat settled. Winston is 26 now. He just turned 26 last month. So now is kind of the right time. It's like he's managed. Yeah, I mean, DJM is asking kind of the obvious question, like, is this going to make him play better? And I think it can help at this point. Yeah. Because
that's what I was going to say. It can only go up from here, right? His play can only go up from here. Like, his vision will be a lot clearer. He doesn't have any kind of impediment that he has to work with, right? He doesn't have to use goggles. He doesn't have to wear contact lenses. Like, he just has to use his eyes, and that's it.
Well, and I guess speaking as somebody who wears just, like, slight corrective lenses, there's still a difference in what you notice once you put on glasses for the first time. It's like you can still tell. You can walk around. You can casually read things, or like it takes you, like, you know, maybe two seconds or so to read something that somebody with perfect vision can spot, like, instantly. So I think when it comes to a game where you're trying to look downfield and assess coverage, you know, maybe it takes you, you know, 2 seconds to, or I mean, that might be a little bit long, but, you know, maybe it takes you like a half second to determine that, oh, that guy that you've got downfield is being covered by two other people there. And maybe that's something that takes him, instead of a half second, maybe it takes him a quarter of a second when he's got perfect vision. So, you know, it, just being able to make those reads faster and being confident in those reads. Like, he's obviously very talented if he's managed to throw for 30 touchdowns, but also, like, something is getting him to throw these 30 interceptions, too. And I think some of it just might be poor reads that come from just an inability to either make decisions fast enough or maybe just incorrectly making decisions because the things he's supposed to see just don't come to mind as quickly as they should. So it's like, at the very least, it'll just be one less thing for him to have to worry about while going through his check down. So I didn't realize that this was bothering him this entire time. So I'm very curious now that I've gotten all my jokes out of the way. Jameis 20 for 20, et cetera. Like this now that.
I think that, and I said this on Twitter a few days ago when the story broke, think about this for Jameis Winston. He has been able to do all of this nearsighted. It's been his entire football career so far nearsighted. He won a national championship at Florida State with an undefeated season nearsighted. He was the number one overall pick nearsighted. He's had seasons in the league where he's thrown 5,000 yards and thrown a bunch of touchdowns and all of that stuff. Big fantasy numbers, nearsighted. And now he's a free agent, and now the word has gotten out that he's fixed his eyesight. Do you think this might affect how he's seen in free agency?
Yes, absolutely. And I think that's part of also the timing as well, because, I mean, obviously it was not a very good end of the season for him in Tampa Bay. Like, ending your season on a pick six to clinch the 30 for 30 achievement. That moment will, like, we were live on here when that happened. Like, that moment will go down in history as one of the greatest infamous moments in all of football history. It's not a very good end of the season. That's kind of the sour taste that he's left in everybody's mouth, and so because of that, I think it's nice to, like, change the narrative a little bit, that, like, oh, he's going to be better than what you saw from him to end the season. He's not going to be the 30 for 30 guy anymore. He might be 30 for 20 next year with this improved vision. He might even be 30 for 10. He's capable of throwing for 5,000 yards. You know, he's capable of throwing for 30 touchdowns. Now you know that he's going to be capable of throwing for fewer interceptions. It's just a question of whether you can get him to do that or not. And now you know that there's going to be a better chance, because, you know, at least his vision is not going to be bothering him. So as far as where is Jameis Winston going to go, it seems like Tampa Bay is open they're open to bring him back, but they want to see what their other options are for now. I think the Chargers have officially given up on Philip Rivers. Still a question about whether the Patriots want to stick with Tom Brady or not, or go with somebody else finally. So those are kind of the options. Las Vegas might get rid of David Carr, but DJM is demanding a hot take from us. So my hot take is that the Patriots are going to take a gamble on Jameis Winston and turn him into the amazing player that we know he can be.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I don't know where he lands. I don't know if it's the Patriots, but I think there's definitely going to be a high value team that maybe feels like the quarterback is the thing that they're missing. And that's the team that'll go for him. Might be the Giants, might be the Saints, maybe. I don't know. Like, but there is a definite high value team who's going to look at him to be their quarterback.
Well, apparently Taysom Hill, who wasn't a good enough quarterback to even back up Drew Brees this season, apparently he is supposed to be the quarterback of the future in New Orleans for some reason. I don't think the Bengals will go for him because I think they'll want to go for whoever they pick number one overall. I mean, the Browns could always use a quarterback, but I think they want to build around Baker Mayfield. I think just like any team that's sort of in the running for Tom Brady, I think you got to put them in the running for Jameis Winston as a consolation prize. But maybe at Tom Brady's age, Jameis Winston shouldn't be the consolation prize. He should be the prize. He might be the quarterback to go for this offseason now. DJ mentions the Chicago Bears. Like, I think they should definitely shop for another quarterback. The Broncos, I think you mentioned last week. So nobody believes in Joe Flacco anymore.
No. That's just a hard no.
Okay. All right, let's move on to baseball. We got a lot of baseball stuff to talk about, even though it's the off season. Minor league baseball players are finally getting raises. So I think that was one of our wait and see items. Is all this reshuffling for minor league baseball going to actually lead to anything for the players? So it looks like everybody is getting raises of at least 38%. So single A players are getting raises from $290 to $400 a week. The $290 amount is equivalent to 40 hours a week at federal minimum wage. But as we've mentioned in some of our previous stories, like there's a cap on like the amount of hours that they can charge for. So once they hit 40, then they're, I believe the term is they're exempt at that point from being paid more. So at least they've upped that ceiling. So they're actually, when they do have those weeks where they work for more than 40 hours a week, they're getting more than federal minimum wage. I think that was the biggest issue from before. Double A players are getting a bump from $350 a week to $600 a week. Triple A players get a bump from $502 a week to $700 a week. These are basically their minimum salaries. So at the very least, it seems like Major League Baseball has heard everybody's concerns or everybody's complaints about how little their minor league players are making. And at least they're doing enough that I think just to get people off their back for now. These are still, it's still kind of poverty level wages, but it's still, it's better than what they were doing before. It is better than the bare minimum that they were doing before. The bare minimum that then dropped below the bare minimum whenever players had long weeks. That's one sign that they might be looking to treat their minor league players a little bit better. But then you've got the Mets, who went and built a $57 million clubhouse for one of their Florida single A teams. They built it for themselves basically because that's where they do spring training. They also, $55 million of this $57 million came from taxpayer dollars. So they didn't even really build it. They just strong-armed the local area to helping them pay for this. And they've decided that minor league players are not allowed to use this clubhouse. Again, this is not a clubhouse in New York where the Mets play. This is just where they're hanging out for spring training.
Yeah.
So for about 6 weeks a year, they get to use the clubhouse. And then after that, nobody gets to walk inside this place at all. Like, this is, despite the fact that it's the people in the city where they're holding spring training that have paid for this place. So for some reason, the logic is that, like, you gotta earn the right to hang out in this little clubhouse, you know, on these nice fancy couches and whatever. Minor league players, despite the fact that they play there, cannot use this place. Like, that.
Yeah, this is just kind of a gross, like show a flourish for no reason. Like, and then I think it's just it's I don't know, it's just dumb. Like, I don't, it's just so bad. It's bad PR. It's bad that you spent that much money on it. It just is bad in so many ways.
Yeah. And it just compounding the fact that it's the Mets. So it's, you know, yeah. Like GM just said, it feels like Mets things. It's, you know, just, you know, add to the long list of dumb behavior.
Bullshit.
Yeah. Unnecessary bullshit from the Mets.
Yeah, hate the Mets. Find a better team. The Yankees are open. Going on from there, there is talks of a Major League Baseball playoff expansion. This one coming to us from The Guardian. So what's kind of the breakdown of this?
Yeah, so currently there's five teams that make the playoffs. Team number 4 and 5, they play this one game wild card. At the end of the season, and then the winner of that game gets to participate in the normal 4-team playoff in each league. So in total, 10 teams make the playoffs out of 30. They want to add 4 teams to that mix. So each league will then have 7 teams make the playoffs. The top team gets a bye for the first week, and then the remaining 6 teams will play each other, and then the winners will then be the winning 3 teams from those series will then join the normal 4-team playoff. So it's kind of like you got 6 wildcard teams in a way.
Mm-hmm.
And also they're changing, instead of a 1-game playoff, that's now a 3-game playoff. The team that has home field advantage gets all 3 games at home. If all 3 are necessary. The other interesting wrinkle to this is that the top teams, the ones with home field advantage in this case, get to choose their opponents instead of this being done by record or seeding, which I think is a nice wrinkle to all this. I've long thought that the NBA should go this route. Like, you pick your opponents, and then there's automatic bulletin board material from if you choose somebody and you avoid choosing other teams, then there's like instant trash talk of like, oh, this team's scared of this other team, or this team wants to challenge this other team, or this team chose you because they think you are
guys. It's time for me to be traditional old baseball guy, because I think that there have been a lot of attempts to change things in baseball, which I generally have had no problem with, but this one, for whatever reason, really irks me. Mm-hmm. And in recent years, I have loved the one game playoff, the one game wild card play in, the game 163, as it's called. I've loved that, and I think that we've had a really good model for playoffs in baseball. I understand that MLB probably wants more teams in the playoff hunt because that generates excitement for baseball, that generates excitement for more teams, and it generates excitement all the way to literally the last day of the season, which is awesome. But something about all of this just feels really overdone and really overthought. And this feels like hyper-analysis. And like, I thought the playoff model for baseball in recent years was really, really good. I don't understand why this is being changed.
When I started to read this earlier, it seemed convoluted. But then kind of after listening to JVZ talk about it, it seemed less convoluted. It still seems there seems to be a bit of unnecessariness in here. It seems like it started from a good place and then got weird when they tried to figure out how to get all these teams in here.
Yeah, and part of why it sounds convoluted is because the way the way this article tried to explain it is a little bit messy, because they get into, like, you know, what order teams choose their opponents and all that stuff, and mm-hmm. most of that is kind of, you know, irrelevant to the overall point that, like, the we've got seven teams now, one wild card round, teams choose their opponents. I think this is kind of, it feels a little dirty to a lot of people right now, because it seems like they're announcing it at the same time as all this Astros stuff is going on. So it feels like they're just trying to, you know, throw in a story for, like, a distraction. There's also, I don't necessarily see why they need to jump from five teams make the playoffs to seven teams make the playoffs. Like, you don't need to add four more, because you are getting dangerously close to NBA territory where more than half the league makes the playoffs. For baseball now, you've got all, they go with this, 14 teams make the playoffs out of 30. So you've got almost half, and you've got a season that is twice as long in terms of the number of games as the NBA season.
It just generates excitement for your team, especially if they're a fringe playoff team, as they say. It generates buzz till the end of the season.
And I mean, one of the nice things about this is this might be one of the only ways that we ever get to see Mike Trout in the playoff again. So,
oh, Lord.
So, like, it's, yeah, like, it, maybe, like, if they found a way to get more teams involved in the playoffs, I just don't know why they couldn't have just gone from five to six instead of five to seven. It seems like a big jump, because it requires, you know, like, the NFL playoffs are six teams each, and they've been that way for a long time, even after expansion. And I don't get the, like, you never have the situation where you hear somebody say, I think too many teams make the playoffs in the NFL. I think it feels like it's just the right amount. And I think for a while, baseball's felt like
not enough.
I think when you go from five to seven, it's just such a thin line. But I feel like when you go from five to seven, it's
and for those that don't know, right? It sounds like we probably sound crazy, because you're just like, it's only two more teams, but it is exponential to what that means in earlier stages of these things leading up to this. You know what I mean? Because you're still at an uneven number of teams, and then now you have to have three division, you know, so it gunks up the system, where I think one more team, just to kind of even things out, would have made a lot more sense.
Yeah, and then you just move to the NFL structure, where you have two teams with a bye, and then four teams mm-hmm. in the wild card round. And
yeah,
so it's, yeah, and that's a format everybody understands, because the NFL has done it forever. I do like the three game wild card round. I don't like it when, yeah, I mean, yeah, that game 163 is very high stakes for both of the teams involved. But I think it's my bias as an A's fan, because they've lost that game recently, and so it's like, oh, we've had this big long season of success, and then we just, you know, and then it all goes away in one game. So it feels like you should at least, even if you have to play on the road for all three of those games, then
it just feels like options.
Yeah, at least you have more than one game to settle this. I think that going from one game to three, that comes from a good place. I think allowing more teams into the playoffs on principle, just a little bit, that comes from a good place. I think the timing of it is part of why everybody's really sour about it.
It's awkward, it's too many steps, and it's just weird. As you mentioned before, the Astros are one of these baseball teams, if you still want to call them that. We're coming to a place where the Astros somehow, some way, have fucked up the apology tour. I don't know how you do this. You had a simple structure. You apologize to everyone. You make sincere things. You pay your fines. You do some charity work, and maybe people forget about it. But they, for some reason, can't even do that right. So, one, you have a story in here from The Ringer about how they're just apologies are not doing what they should be. We have a Washington Post thing talking about how they're now being sued. How are the Astros fucking this up, JBZ?
Yeah, I mean, this starts at the top. Jim Crane held a press conference at the start of spring training, and then, you know, he very, very clearly approached it from the kind of "I'm sorry you were offended" approach. And that never works. He somehow managed to say that this didn't affect the result of games, and then walked it back like a couple minutes later, saying that he never said that. it was a mess, and that started off the mess. And then at that point, like, the press is out for blood. So now they're interviewing other players, and some of them are trying to be apologetic about it. And other ones are just saying, like, no, we don't owe anybody, no, we haven't reached out to the Dodgers. We haven't, we don't think we owe anybody anything at this point. Just comments that are, along those lines. And so now everybody's just pissed off at them all over again. And when they already kind of were pissed off, and now it just seems like they're leaning hard into the villain role. And I shouldn't say they're leaning, with it almost seems unintentional, but it's like they very clearly don't seem to get it. Like how bad what they did was, and how upset everybody else is about it. And they got sued by Mike Bolsinger, who is one of those players who appeared just very briefly in the league, but because he got shelled by the Astros because they were stealing his signs, he no longer has a career in the league. Whether you think like that's the sole reason for that, he wasn't that good of a pitcher coming in, but I don't know whether he has a legal leg to stand on here, but he's not the only pitcher that can make this claim either. And careers were hurt, legacies were hurt, the achievements that the Astros achieved were undeserved. They kind of effectively, outside of a couple people, they got kind of a slap on the wrist. Effectively they lost what, four draft picks total, mm-hmm. like two first round picks this year, and then another two. Or sorry, a first round and second round pick this year, next year. And that's pretty much it. And then they lost their manager, they lost their GM, but the owner escapes unscathed. All the players escape unscathed. So, like, baseball players are notoriously petty. Like, they have these all these weird ass unwritten rules about, like, where you're allowed to walk, like how you're allowed to show off and stuff. And it's like, if you do so much as, like, you know, you just stare too long at the home run you just hit, then somebody's going to beat you with a ball the next time you come up to bat. So, extrapolate that to, like, you know, everybody is so pissed off about this Astros thing, and they're acting like such assholes about it too. Yeah. You can imagine, like, what players are going to try to do to them. And like, I'm speaking about this as somebody who has said that this practice of throwing at people is stupid and dangerous. But, like, I'm worried that this is just going to become a thing in every game that the Astros play in. Like, they're just going to, like, they're going to get in so many fights this year. They put their own players in danger by this. And some of the players that are on the roster are players that have not participated in the scandal. So, it's...
Yeah. So, there is the possibility of a lot more stuff coming to light with this podcast that could be coming out. Because it's going to be kind of an in-depth documentary series talking about the 2017 run of the Houston Astros. And then that can either just add more flames to the fire or maybe help absolve some people from it. But it's definitely not going to be a good look for the Astros as an organization.
And not a good look for baseball in general, because it seems like the more stuff comes out, the more it seems like Major League Baseball tried to hide a lot of this because they were worried about how it would look. But, you know, like, we've heard that story over and over again with so many different things. Like, you know, trying to hide stuff and bury stuff just delays the inevitable. And once it comes out, then people are just more pissed off that you tried to hide this. Like, you know, every team has complained about the Astros. Every team thought that this was a thing that was happening, and then they were kind of gaslit and told that, no, it's not a problem, or we're looking into it. And then it wasn't until The Athletic broke the story that that Major League Baseball actually tried to do something about this. And then once they did, then, you know, now it's turned into this big thing that they can't make go away. And they've lost control of this, and they can't even give out punishments that that fit the crime here. Like, the, you know, I've been talking with my coworker Joe, and I think he brought up the idea of, like, you know, forcing a dispersal draft. I know Kaz, last week you said just completely get rid of the Astros for a season, like, suspend them, and I think that has revenue implications. So, like, I don't think anybody would go for that. But, like, I think we've seen in college sports, like, the quote unquote death penalty is a postseason suspension for, like, 4 years or so, and that affects recruitment, that affects so many different things.
And they also linked to kind of as a parallel, this Manchester City ban from the European club competitions for 2 seasons for their discretions against, but for UEFA rules and things like that. So that's 2 seasons out of the Champions League and things like that. In a sense, I almost wish baseball, because I think it's the closest sport we have to possibly ever doing it, had a relegation kind of thing. And I wish we could just demote the Astros to you know, the lowest that there is. I wish minor leagues worked differently, then we could just demote the Astros.
Yeah, and I believe that's also happened in the English Premier League. I think Leeds United is still trying to work their way up back into the Premier League after being demoted over a decade ago because of, I forget what the violation was, but also Juventus in the Italian league, they had a match fixing scandal, which is very serious. It's just as serious as you know, a sign stealing scandal like this. And you know, they were demoted for like a year, but obviously kicked out of Champions League competition. They managed to work their way back up, but just that one year caused them to lose a couple players because you know, players don't want to stick around for that. So,
and that's what I would love to see happen to the Astros.
Yeah, something like that, like a postseason ban or something, like whatever the NCAA puts out a ban for stuff like that. It's like the reason that they always use is lack of institutional control. And then so when you see the Astros owner, you know, come out and say that, like, you know, this he had nothing to do with this. Like, this was just something that they, you know, the people working for him did on their own, but he had nothing to do with this himself, so he shouldn't be punished. Well, he should be punished for lack of institutional control. So it's, you know, I would love like a dispersal draft, like not only disperse all these players, scatter them around the league, but make the Astros pay their salaries for, you know, for like a year or two and gut their draft, because at least any, you know, anything that forces the Astros to be bad, they will just tank and, you know, and try to profit from that by getting better draft picks in the coming years. So like you have to gut that too. So I mean, just two picks from two drafts is not enough. Like it's got to be. These drafts go like 30 some rounds and last several days. Like, it should be like at least all the day one picks, or you know, or the first 10 rounds of every draft. Like the, you know, like this team should be gutted at this point, and you know, beyond recognition. You know, Jim Crane should be forced to sell the team. Like, the punishments should be that harsh for something that, you know, taints a World Series, you know, and taints at least two World Series at this point. Like, you don't know what they did since 2017. There's no reason to believe that they decided on their own to just stop cheating. So people would feel less angry about this had the Astros not acted like assholes over the past week. So that's kind of the story that I'm trying to highlight this week. But
yeah, so we definitely want to see more punishment for them, but it's probably not going to happen because the MLB is going to bend over backwards to keep their owners happy, and the Astros owner being one of them, he won't get what he wants in the end.
Yeah. And I think they're worried that there's other teams doing this, and so they don't want this investigation to go further. But at this point, everybody is, like, just get everything out in the open now. Just, like, any team that's... Because this hurts the overall league image at this point. You can't trust that a game result is a legitimate result anymore. And once you get to that point, then people are going to stop watching because they're going to think that it's all fixed.
All right, moving on from there to, I guess, it's just an odd event. The Mighty Ducks are now the bad guys. So Disney Plus, Disney's streaming service, is doing a sequel, I guess?
Yeah. A TV season, at least, 10 episodes.
Yeah. A not a retelling, this is more of a continuation, but there's like four movies. So it's a 10 episode miniseries that are following the Mighty Ducks as now being a powerhouse team in their youth competition league. But the new kid is cut, or the kid is cut from their team and helps form a new ragtag team to challenge the once ragtag but now mighty Ducks, which I guess goes to be that saying, you either die a hero or you live long enough to become the bad guy.
Yeah, and then I don't know, reviews, or I guess reaction to this is kind of mixed, but I'm a little bit interested in this. The idea being that they want to challenge the cutthroat win-at-all-costs culture of competitive youth sports, which is something that we complain about a lot, a lot of times when it comes to parents and the way they treat youth athletes. And so I want to see how they tackle this, especially over a 10-episode season where there's a little bit more nuance than what you can get from a movie. So it is weird to see, like, this, this team that we thought of these guys as the plucky underdogs before, and now they're the evil empire. But at the same time, I think we've seen that happen a lot in sports where, like, oh, the Boston Red Sox, for a long time, they were kind of the underdogs, and now they're, they win a World Series every 5 years or so. And,
I think storyline-wise, because of its history, it gives you a lot of interesting things to look at, and I think even posing that question makes it an interesting, at least first episode viewing kind of a thing.
Yeah, if they just start the story with, oh, the Mighty Ducks are bad now, like, that's then I think that's gonna.
I think Great that's where it goes, and then you explore how they got there throughout the season.
Hey, guys.
Right?
Because guys.
Yeah.
Did either of you watch the YouTube series Cobra Kai?
I did not, but I've heard of it, and I was thinking of this. Cobra Kai, as you mentioned this, because, if I'm not correct, it's now, like, They flipped, like, who is the hero from Karate Kid and who is the villain now, or it's like...
Well, it's more like Johnny Lawrence, who was Daniel LaRusso's rival in The Karate Kid, is now the protagonist of Cobra Kai, and he's sort of an anti-hero protagonist, and Daniel LaRusso isn't a bad guy per se, but there's conflict. And that's what this reminded me of. We're 30 years from the original, and things have changed, because things changed in 30 years. And I guess it sounds interesting, because Cobra Kai actually worked out really well. It was actually pretty good. So, I don't know. I'm mildly interested.
Now you have the budget of Disney. I'm sure they could get Emilio Estevez to come back. I'm calling it now. He comes back in episode 5. Because he finds out what happens to the team, and his heart is broken.
Or, since he actually started the series as not being that great of a guy to begin with, maybe he devolved into...
Well, it's already confirmed. He will be in the series.
And then Lauren Graham is starring as the mom of the protagonist kid, so those of you who enjoyed Gilmore Girls will be happy to see her in this. For some reason, Disney Plus does not allow you to watch the original Mighty Ducks movies, at least until July 1st, 2020, because of their existing licensing agreements. So you can't even parlay this news into watching the originals, but hopefully by the time this series comes out, at least the first Mighty Ducks movie will be available, since this does focus on, like, the local Minnesota hockey scene rather than kind of the national or high school level scene that they were doing in the later movies. So I disagree with this article that, like, this is just a terrible tragedy that, you know, they've taken the good guys and they've turned them into the cake eaters now. Like, I think this is an important story that if they do this right, then I think we'll enjoy it. And it'll cause us to look at ourselves and look at the pressure that we put on the youth of today and ask whether we're doing this the right way when it comes to how we treat youth sports.
Yeah, I mean, I think if it goes that route, but I'm just scared that it won't. I'm just scared that it's going to just kind of be really dumb.
a money grab by Disney, which
yeah,
they are known to do.
But they are also really known to do really good things. So, as we say, this is going to be a wait and see. That's it for this episode of Sports Odds and Ends. We thank you all for joining us. TGM thinks he's slick because he called me out, but that's what our series is here to do. We wait and see how things turn out. Ban the Astros. Have a good night. Have a good day. And make sure you come on back for some good sports news. You can follow us all on Twitter. I'm Matt King Cash. JVZ is at JVZ. DJM is calling me DJM. Make sure you go on over to the website, sportsoutsandins.com, to read all the stories that we talked about this show. And also, if you would like, head on over to the Patreon, patreon.com/sportsoutsandins.